lock the door now, right? Alright. So, as we've done not once, but now twice, the line in your notebooks, because we are moving onward to exam number 3. As I'm going to start saying a lot now that we're back from break, papers, 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 papers. Forget, you have to do research paper in here. Paper is not that long, but it does count as 20% of the grade. It is due April sometime or other. I think the 21st, if memory serves me correctly. It's 2 weeks before the end of the semester. So do not forget about that. You still have the ability to get extra points if you do an early submission. You're going to drop it into Engage. There's a little drop area there above the exams. If you get it in by the end of the month, I think I said +3, I think, at this point. I don't remember where I'm at. Maybe +5. I got to go back and watch the tape. I don't remember. But you could potentially get extra points. One of my students, not in this class, but in one of my other classes, actually got his paper in at the end of February, and he was able to earn, yeah, maybe I did say +5, because he got +7. But the student had the advantage because he's had me before, several times before, so he knew how I grade papers. If you have not done so, make sure as you get close to finishing your paper, you go on proflamatic.com, go into the paper section, read the directions, go down on the bottom, look where I take points off of. Because this is assignment, like I said on the pre-class video, it's more about you following directions. It doesn't matter if you're a strong writer or a weak writer. If you don't follow the directions, you won't get a good grade on it. So make sure you understand the directions. And of course, if you have any questions, ask. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Because if you have a question, chances are someone else has that question. But I only mention that because I had, I think I told you guys, I had one young lady that rushed it in to get the extra bonus points. She didn't follow any of the directions. She ended up failing the paper. So yeah, she got like +5 or whatever, but +5 on a 30 is still an F. So make sure you follow the directions. Yes, sir. Yes. Yep, yeah. So you already told me what you're going to write about. Of course, like I did say, if you start doing your research and you hit a brick wall, if there's either too much or not enough, you can change your topics. Just let me know. That's not a problem. Just send me an email. So do not forget. Papers, 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 papers. As far as exam 2 goes, I think everyone in here took it. I opened them up, right, for you guys? Okay, so you know what you got. And I was able to factor those in when I submitted your midterm grades. So midterm grades are 30%. That's all it is. Represents 30% of your final average. So if you get an A or if you get an F, doesn't matter. It's only 30% of your grade. You still have 70% to go. So if you're struggling, now's the time to buckle down and maybe start doing some of those extra credit questions. Very few people submitted them. And those who did, they did fine. They got full credit on it. It boosted their averages up. So there's still plenty of extra credit opportunities available. Plus, when we get towards the final exam, you got a mega packet, which will allow you to get a shit ton of extra credit in. It's just a matter of doing it. But don't do that extra credit until we get to the final exam, because that's geared toward that information. All right. We've dealt with the age of exploration. You know why the Europeans left, why they began circling the globe. We know they were trying to tap the Asian trade network. Of course, they didn't know how vast it was until they got there, but we know they got there. Of course, the Spanish conquered, you know, the Central and South America, conquered the Philippines, and the Portuguese, they tried making trading posts. But by the 18th and going into the 19th century, Europeans more and more focused on controlling the flow of goods. Now, during the 1800s, that's what we're talking about, the 19th century, there was less emphasis on colonies and there was more emphasis on economic control, because who in their right mind doesn't like money? But Europeans now having access to all corners of the globe caused them to change their perspectives. And what started developing in the 1820s and 1830s is a whole series of new schools of thought, attitudes towards things, which are collectively known as isms. So you got like industrialism, for example, or Marxism, for example. Anytime you see an ism at the end, that usually represents a movement, an intellectual movement. Now, of course, the French Revolution, huge, inspired a whole bunch of them. Conservatism, liberalism, nationalism, socialism. But of course, there were other movements as well. Now, why did these attitudes develop? Well, society was changing. Europe began the process of industrialization. They moved away from making everything by hand and instead replacing it with machines. And the Industrial Revolution that would take root in Europe would soon spread. It would spread over to America, the United States. It would spread to the continent. And this Industrial Revolution caused a desire for more resources. Because machines could make things quicker than you could by hand. So to keep the machines going, you had to keep getting more stuff. Now, ironically, one of the reactions to the Industrial Revolution was the birth of many of the modern fields of science. Things like physics, chemistry, biology, they all began forming. Because in order to make sure the machines function properly, you had to understand the physics behind it, thermodynamics, things along those lines. But it was quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. Technology would propel human progress. I mean, if you're able to take a snapshot, look at how people lived just 200 years ago. Most of the people on Earth were farmers. They were involved in agricultural food production. Most of the people were born in, you know, little country towns. And they probably would spend their entire lives there. And then you go back 500 years, and that's the same way people lived. You go back 1,000 years, that's the way people lived. But if you do the same leap backwards, go back just 100 years. You had the rise of modern cities, trains, locomotives, electricity, light bulbs. It's only been in the last 150 years or so that the modern world in which we take advantage of came into existence. And it was all because of this. The desire for more. And the more advancements occurred, the more science became important. Again, if you're going to have an engine, you have to understand thermodynamics. You know, the way heat impacts metal. If you're going to have one of these stupid little things, you have to understand electromagnetism. You know, the combination of electricity and magnets in order to get electrical devices to function. I mean, after all, the science that was developed 150 years ago is the basis of all modern technology. All of the things that you just love. And the more people learned, the more the science spread globally. Why? They automated printing presses. Printing presses usually for 100 years was done by manpower. But you attach a steam engine to it,
And suddenly you're able to pump out book after book after book after book after book. And these books were shipped across the world. And for the first time, you had people in China, people in Japan, people in Africa, reading books that were published in Europe, learning these sciences. Education changed. If you went to college 200 years ago, chances are a good amount of it would be religion, but you also learned the classics. Rhetoric, speech, like giving speeches, public speaking, logic. Well, all of that was scrapped and replaced with liberal arts, focusing on STEM, because it was science that began making the world go round. All right. I'm going somewhere with this. Questions? Yes.
So, still in the to some extent, because what is happening right now is based on what they started like almost 150 years ago.
Yeah.
So that means we're still limited in some areas.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Or maybe they discovered the truth, the facts, but we're still taking advantage of the work that they did. Now, in terms of where we're going, we're focusing on economic and political and social history. Out of all of the fields of science that appeared, one of them was most significant in the sense that it changed the way human beings looked at one another. Darwinism. You know who Charles Darwin is, right? He developed the theory of evolution. Which is what?
Atheism?
Evolution is atheism?
Oh, you're talking about like... My bad.
What type of changes?
Like bodily changes?
Yeah, physical changes. Yeah, change. The change was natural. All right. The way people used to think all over the earth since the beginning of recorded history was that there was a higher power, a being, a god, that created everything and controlled everything. And everything was static. There was no change other than the passage of time. But Darwin comes in and says, no, change, evolution is nature. That things start off as a primitive form and eventually evolve generation after generation and generation into something different. Now, by the way, his book on the origins of species by means of natural selection, not that you need to remember that, published in 1859, is arguably one of the most influential books in history. Because again, it contradicted the religions of the world and creationism. And by the way, it's not just the Old Testament. The book of Genesis that talks about creationism. All world religions are based on a god or a goddess creating mankind. But it's his arguments on what evolution is, how it occurs, that's significant. Argument number one. All organisms reproduce naturally, but reproduction is a struggle. A struggle to exist. Why? Competition.
food.
In order for a species to exist, it must eat. And if the food sources cease to be, the organism is going to cease to exist. So, the organism needs to engage in a fight to survive, to get that food. Because food equals life, no food equals death. So what does this mean? Some things are going to get food, some things are not. Which means nature itself creates winners and losers. Who wins? The best, the most fit. Darwin tells us that those creatures best suited to get the food are the ones who get to procreate. The strong shall survive, the weak shall die. Now, the funny thing is according to Darwin, the end result is the winners who have the best traits pass those traits on to their offspring. So, while the variations may be slight, generation to generation, over time, those superior traits are going to continue to evolve. And every species has something that makes them strong. You know what ours is? We can do something, Homo sapiens, we can do something that no other creature on Earth can do. We can take our thumb and touch our pinky. We have opposable thumbs. We're the only creature on Earth that has ever had this. And this is how we've become the dominant creature on Earth. Because we can grab things and hold them tight and use it to kill. How do we get it? Well, if you believe Darwin, we evolved. And what has allowed us to do it? Nature. Nature determines the winners and losers. It's nature. Some point, some hominid, once they were walking around on their all fours, stood up and realized they could do this. And if, again, if you believe in evolution, from primitive Lucy, I can't remember her scientific name. I know Africanus is in there somewhere. But the hominid species have evolved from little Lucy all the way up to modern Homo sapiens sapiens. And what about the 99% of species that have lived on Earth that no longer exist? Well, guess what? They didn't have characteristics that allow them to survive the changes that occur on Earth. The biggest thing being climate change, which has always happened. You do realize just 10,000 years ago, if we were here, we'd be a mile under ice, right? Thank God for global warming, because imagine having to get to class by digging a tunnel a mile deep. That's the reason why the dinosaurs went away, or all the different bugs, or the woolly mammoths. They didn't have the traits that allowed them to adapt. We do. We can do this. And this allowed us, for instance, to be able to make shelter that can survive all climate change, that will allow us to wear clothes to keep warm, or we can shed clothes if it gets too hot. No other species can do that. All right, questions on evolution. Now, of course, like every new idea, it often inspires other ideas that usually are, we'll call them pirated, borrow. As Darwinism became entrenched in the minds of Western civilization, an offshoot of it appeared, known as social Darwinism, in which thinkers took the ideas of Darwin and applied them to society. And it would give rise to new fields of thought in the social sciences and also in terms of human relations. But the three core ideas remained. That at a societal level, human beings are engaged in a struggle. And the winners will survive. And the losers will go the way of the dodo bird. The biggest area where this was applied to was economics. So, in terms of global competition, you know, one country, one company has to get to wherever the resources are first and suck it all out of the ground. Because if they don't, their business or their country will go out of business. And by them taking it, it stops others from getting it. And the language was the same. The fit survive, the weak die. Now, ironically, social Darwinist ideas confirms the ideas of the 19th century liberals. We're talking people like Thomas Jefferson. You know, our founding fathers were classical liberals. That's what we're talking about. You know, they argued things for like laissez-faire economics. You know, no government control. That you as an individual should be free to go out and prosper or fail based on your own efforts. Why? Well, simple. Thomas Jefferson and others believed that you know what's best for you, not the government. So you should be able to freely do what you want. Of course, what does that mean? Well, if you work hard, you potentially could become very rich. And if you don't work hard enough, you're going to become homeless. But here's the dark side. Social Darwinism would also bring with it very hard views of society. So, if you read the books of the 19th century, the themes are consistent. Hard work, thrift. So you be thrifty, you just don't buy, you look for the best price. Self-help. You know, you never ask anyone for help, you just do it. Those were argued as the key factors in success. Why did people fail? Well, social Darwinists would say they are lazy. They are wasteful. They're stupid. Or even most importantly, they rely upon others. They want someone else to do it for them. Well, guess what? If you expect mommy and daddy to show up and do your job, you're going to fail. So, social Darwinists argued essentially that the poor were poor because they're unfit. They didn't do whatever was required not to be poor. So they were wasteful. But if you really want to apply Darwinist ideas, this means they're also useless. They have no value. There were many writers associated with this movement that argued ideas along the lines of, if you can't afford to eat because you don't make enough money, well, you should die. And that will free up surplus food for those who work. And they would argue, at the end of the day, it's for the greater good of the species. Again, if you apply it to modern society, you do realize less than half of the people in America actually work and pay taxes, right? But slightly more than half live off the government. Which means if you go out and do it the way that I was told as a kid that is the right way, you actually have to work harder because you are providing for all of those other people that could work but choose not to. Because today we don't live by social Darwinism, we live by socialism. And that's just not fair. Question, Ernest?
Nope. All right. Now, does this mean they were all awful? No. There were definitely, like any movement, there was a variety, there was a spectrum of views.
And so rather than talking about every single idea that was associated with social Darwinism, I'm going to give you the two bookends. On one hand, you had social Darwinist writers like Herbert Spencer. He was a primary advocate for what became known as social evolution. Social evolution. In other words, he argued in his book, Social Studies, published in 1850, that the superior societies should shape civilization in a way that's for the better. That strong societies, fit societies, should use their success to shape human civilization. Now, truth be told, he's arguing for imperialism. He's saying that the superior country should go and conquer the inferior countries and then bring them up to modern standards. But he wasn't talking about what some of the extreme social Darwinists were talking about. Let the weak die. No. He actually argued the exact opposite. He said that through imperialism, the stronger country could remove the barriers that keeps the weaker countries down. Because after all, why are some societies more advanced than others? Well, those others may not have the equal access to resources. So, for example, take the people who live in the deserts, the Bedouins. You know, they make their existence by going from oasis to oasis. And there are still Bedouins in this world today. They raise and travel in camels, with camels. They don't have flashy cell phones and flashy technology. Why? Well, there's no water in the desert. So what should superior people do? They should bring those traits to the inferior people. So I challenge you, when you're an adult, try to go anywhere on earth where you cannot find a McDonald's. Because America has brought all the good stuff to everyone on earth. McDonald's, rock and roll, rap, Coca-Cola. Because in America, in the last 100 years, we've embraced Spencer's ideas. And they boil down to what's known as altruism. Anyone know what altruism is? Altruism is a selfless concern for others. Spencer argued that kindness, compassion, love, that's proof of evolution. So, if you try to help out somebody who's in need, you're engaged in an act of altruism. And the fact that you think of that other person, that's proof that you are evolved, that you're not primitive, that you're not selfish. Questions? So that's one bookend. Now I'm going to give you the other bookend. Another prominent social Darwinist, Margaret Sanger. Does anyone not know who Margaret Sanger is? Well, Margaret Sanger was an advocate for what today we call eugenics. What's eugenics? No one?
I've heard.
Eugenics is the science of selective breeding. It's the science of selective breeding. So, you take fit with fit, and you let them breed. But, if an unfit tries breeding with an unfit, you prevent it. Because if the unfit breeds and reproduces, you're just going to have more unfit people. So, you encourage the fit to breed with the fit, you discourage the unfit from breeding. Now, FYI, this is where the Nazis got their ideas that they would use to justify the Holocaust. Because if you ever read any Nazi propaganda, particularly in Mein Kampf, Hitler identifies the Jews as the most unfit species of human beings on Earth. And they needed to be eradicated for the well-being of everybody else. Well, the Nazis did not necessarily directly quote Sanger. You can see her inspiration in their work. Because she started writing in the 19-teens, before the Nazis even existed. FYI, to implement her plan, Margaret Sanger founded a company, an entity that's still around today, called Planned Parenthood. And what was the mission of Planned Parenthood? Well, she described it in her book called Birth Control and Racial Betterment, which is available online. Birth Control and Racial Betterment, published 1919. In it, she called for a reduction of the unfit population through birth control. How would it be achieved? Well, in her book, she calls for a three-step program to purify society. Step number one, for those people, to use her words, not mine, I'm quoting her. By the way, I read her book. I got these excerpts out of her book, so Lemanic's not being cruel. Lemanic's just quoting. She called for the sterilization. We know what sterilization means, right? Okay. Of her words, again, not mine. Those who are profoundly retarded. Morons. mental defectives, epileptics, those people deemed unfit by physical standards. So you're going to stop them from reproducing. But there's another group of people that you have to deal with. The people that aren't so easy to see. People like, again, her words, not mine. People who are illiterate. People who are paupers. Pauper is someone who is basically poor and homeless. Someone who is unemployable. Habitual criminals. Prostitutes. Drug addicts. For those, the government should find them. Inventory them. Write down their names, their locations, and then seize them and confine them. That's confinement. She called for the creations of what she called enclosed farms and open spaces. So you go through the cities and the towns, you round up all these people and you transport them to what the Nazis later called concentration camps. And then once you get rid of the groups of one and the groups of two, all that's left is the group of three, or the third group. A group that she referred to as racial inferiors. Well, you slowly exterminate them by giving out free birth control and abortions. Now, FYI, biracial inferiors, Margaret Sanger was pretty clear in her behavior who she was talking about. For instance, in her own autobiography that she wrote in 1938, she proudly recounts her multiple visits to address women units of the Ku Klux Klan all throughout the 1920s. In 1939, Planned Parenthood launched what was called, and I quote, the Negro Project. And then when word was starting to spread in the newspapers, she actually took the time to write letters to Southern ministers in which she actually said, and I quote, "We do not want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population." FYI, there's a reason why Planned Parenthoods, even today, are all located in inner cities, in minority neighborhoods. This is social Darwinism at its worst. Questions? Well, the weird byproduct of social Darwinism was, for the first time, an organized attempt to define those physical traits that separate us all. And that would give birth to what today we call racism. It's weird. You go back into the 1800s and 1700s and 1600s, and people were acknowledged by their culture or their ethnicity, but there never was referred to by their race. That was until social Darwinism became popular. In the late 19th century, a pseudo school of science appeared, trying to figure out the characteristics of the strong societies and the weak societies. And these social Darwinists recognized, well, there are some groups that are better than others. Tribes, races, nations. And there are some, like I said, that are better than others. Now, it's not the same today because of mass migration, but when 19th century racism was developed, nations themselves pretty much had one ethnicity in them. So England was full of English. Scotland was full of Scottish, Irish, French, German, Italians. Not so much anymore, but back then it was. And these racists realized that some, like the Anglo-Saxons, were inherently way ahead economically, militarily, politically, than others. So, they took Europe and put it on a spectrum. On one hand, you had the Brits and the Germans. They are all of the leaders by all of the metrics that you measure greatness. Well, that caused the 19th century racists to say, well, the British and the Germans, Germanic, Anglo-Saxon blood, well, that must be a superior race. But Slavs, or Croats, or Poles, you know, the nations that are conquered and subjugated, even Gypsies, well, 19th century racists say they must be the inferior whites, if you will. So there's superior and there's inferior. And then they continued, and they realized the same was true of all races. So, for instance, you go to the end of the 19th century, and in Asia, for example, the Japanese, way superior than all of the other people. The Japanese modernized, they built a modern army, a modern navy, they embraced the Industrial Revolution, and they started winning wars. Well, 19th century racists argue, well, the Japanese must be the superior Asian race. And who were the people in the 19th century? They're getting their butts whipped, as we're going to see. Well, it was the Chinese. So, the 19th century racists said Japanese superior, Chinese inferior. All around the world, they started doing this. All of the different skin tones. Some were better than others. And the proof was undeniable. The superior races were winning wars, and they were making advancements. Technologically, economically, and the inferiors were not. So, what does this mean? Well, if you can conquer somebody, then you are superior. And if you are conquered, well, you are inferior. So the winner should take your land, should take your resources. And the loser? Well, if you can't defend your house, you don't deserve it. And there were philosophers writing about this, such as one of the darkest philosophers of the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche. Any of you ever read Nietzsche? Oh my God. Talk about dark and somber. But in one of Nietzsche's books, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he developed the concept of what he referred to as the Übermensch, which is German Uber for super, Mensch, man. In 1883, he basically said there are some men that are superior than others, and the goal of the supermen should be creating super babies. So, how does one achieve having a super baby? Well, do not procreate with Untermensch, inferior or subhumans. So, think of like Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen, or Beyonce and Jay-Z. You know, just gorgeous, beautiful people. Let them be together and produce beautiful, gorgeous babies. But don't mix with anybody else. Because it's the right of the beautiful people to stay beautiful. Now, at its core, 19th century racists had four primary beliefs. And again, by the way, I keep saying 19th century because modern racist theory is very different. These were the ideas 150 years ago. Racist belief number one. They explained racial differences through the prism of evolution. Essentially, that Homo sapiens evolved into separate species. So, different physical features, different skin tones. But it wasn't just the outward, it was also the inward. They argued that cultural differences is also proof of evolution. So, for instance, the tribal structure in Africa in the 19th century. People in Africa in the 19th century were living the same as their ancestors had done 1,000 years before. Well, 19th century racists argued, well, because Africa, the Africans, never evolved technologically, they never evolved economically, well, they must be culturally inferior.
I had someone most of the developed nations around the world have to do with the Jews being present in those areas.
Oh, the Jews?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention the Jews next, because that was another group that got attacked as well. The Jews. Now, we all know Judaism as being a religion, right? Well, the 19th century racists argued that they were a separate race. And the fact that the Jews never had a country until Israel was created, but rather they had to infect other countries. Well, the 19th century racists argued, well, that's proof that the Jews were inferior. They lost their homeland. So, because they have to live off of somebody, that's the reason why Hitler and the Nazis later referred to them as like parasites, like vermin, like fleas that, you know, jump on a dog and suck its blood because they can't create of their own. So what do you do with these inferiors? Well, there were some racists that actually called for their outright extermination. That the Jews, for example, should be removed from Europe. And maybe you dump them somewhere, or maybe you just liquidate them. Africa, there were books that talked about completely depopulating the continent of Africa so you can take all the resources that were there. And lastly, they called for the preservation of bloodlines to prevent weakness. Now, the example of this that I'm going to give you is something that was illegal in most European countries up until the 20th century. Interracial marriage. Interracial marriage was forbidden by custom and law. Even in the United States. All the way up until 1967, there were, I think, 5 states where interracial marriage was illegal. You could go to jail, even between 2 consenting adults, if they loved each other and they said, I do, the government would come in and arrest them. Well, thankfully, the Supreme Court overturned that, declared Virginia's law unconstitutional in 1967. But again, 1967. I know none of you have been around. Were any of you alive in the 1900s? Were you all born like 2000 after? 1967 was just 4 years before I was born. It seems like so long ago, but it's really not. So, we have these attitudes. We have the belief that modern advanced societies have an inherent right to take whatever they want and to treat those people that they deem unfit however they want. Well, ultimately, the biggest consequence of this would give rise to the last major ism that we're going to cover. New imperialism. Beginning in the 1870s, the Europeans did something that they hadn't done since the 16th century. They decided to once again begin conquering territory. But Europe was already occupied. North and South America was already occupied. So where did they look? Well, they began prepared to carve up the continents of Africa and Asia for their own advantage. And it wasn't just one. All of the great powers engaged in this competition. And they used all of the technological advancements to get it. They used science. They use technology. They use their industrial capacity. They use transportation, communication, weaponry. But you know the biggest thing they use? Contracts. They would go into a country and make a deal with a local leader. And the local leader would make a deal with them, like kind of what we talked about, how the Dutch took over Indonesia. So the leader would essentially make a deal with a European country to do business with them. Now that local leader would become rich, would remain in power, but he did so by selling out his own people. Now, of course, again, we covered this. Expansion wasn't new. The Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French, the English, they all made their colonies. But things started getting ferocious in the 1870s. At the top were just 7 nations. In total, there would be 12, but the big ones were the top 7. The biggest winner was England. England, by the 1870s, had the largest empire on earth. They had England, they had Scotland, Ireland, yeah. But they also had Australia. They also had, for all sakes and purposes, control over India. And they wanted to expand. So that's what they began doing, pursuing policies that would allow their empire to get bigger. Well, France was jealous of England and tried competing with England. So France started pushing into Africa really aggressively, conquering up corners of the desert, planting their flag, claiming this is mine. But by the 1870s, there were two countries on Europe. Germany was unified. Italy was unified. And they wanted to be able to flex their muscles. They wanted to be able to show that they were strong. So how do you do it? You go kick the living snot out of some tribal people and you take possession of their land to show, look, I'm tough. Even these United States of America were not immune to it. Manifest destiny. We conquered the continent. But by the 1870s, we began looking globally. We wanted to stop being a hemispheric power, and we wanted to become a global power. We would take over, for instance, Hawaii, Kingdom of Hawaii. Russia? Russia just went across the top of the continent, conquering acres and acres and acres of land, and all of the people that live there. And then the other new kid on the block, Japan. Japan wanted to show that they were the racial superiors of Asia. So they were willing to conquer and subvert. Questions? Almost done for the day. Now, how is it done? Well, unlike the age of exploration, when the conquistadors came and planted the flag in the name of God and King. New imperialism, as I mentioned, was driven by money. Investment capital. So they would go in and give to the government large swaths of cash to invest in infrastructure. Make railroads, make bridges, make roads, clean water sources. In exchange for that quid pro quo, you know, best trading rights. But the weird thing is they didn't necessarily come in and colonize everywhere. Europeans would actually use three different methods in the age of imperialism. 3 degrees of what we shall call protection. Because after all, if you're going to give somebody a whole bunch of money, you want to protect your investment. Now, there were some areas that were fully annexed, colonized. Territory carved out and claimed this was the actual property of, say, England, or say, Spain, or say, France. That definitely occurred. But there was also what were known as protectorates. Like how England took control of India by putting puppets on the throne. And the puppets would make decisions that were good for the controlling country, not necessarily their own people. So think the British Raj, if you remember when we talked about that. So you took control of the country, or you put somebody in charge to control a country. But a new thing began developing, where Europeans decided, we're not going to take the whole country, we're only going to take the areas of it that we want. Well, these became known as spheres of influence. So when we talk about China, what the European countries wanted to do is they wanted to begin taking control of all the ports. So Hong Kong, for example, that would be transferred completely over to England, and that would be an English sphere of influence. So even though the local people were Chinese, they still spoke Chinese, the law that was put in place was British law. But the catch is, you take the map and you start taking chunks and chunks and chunks and chunks, and it becomes part of your empire. Or as this cartoon shows, part of the country's grab bag. Questions? No? Why did they do it? Oh, wait, we go like, we go to 1:30, right? Mm-hmm. We'll go a little further than I thought. Why did they do it? Why? Well, number one, I've talked about this. I mentioned this a couple of times already. If you are operating factories, you want those factories to operate at 100% capacity. You want product after product blowing off the assembly lines. But to do so, you need to access resources. Because the more resources you can get, the more products you can produce. So, for instance, once the United States began manufacturing automobiles in large quantities, the one things that was not here, that you could not access here, was rubber. So in order to make an automobile, you had to have access to rubber resources, rubber that came from Africa. So how do you secure the supply? Well, again, you either go and just take all the land, or you put a puppet in, or you say, well, we're going to take the area where the rubber grows, and it's going to be ours. Because the more resources you get, the more you can produce. The more you produce, the more money you make. And by the way, the more money you make, the more you can sink into the system. Make sense? And what motivated the nations to do this? Well, nationalism. All the way up, except for the last maybe decade or two, every single politician in America was always about America. But then suddenly that started not being popular. Instead of worrying about the red, white, and blue, we began worrying about other people in other parts of the earth. Like what's going on in the Ukraine, which has nothing to do with us. Well, during the 19th century, it was all about making England greater, or France greater, or Germany greater. So in order for you, your country, your people to benefit, you need to take advantage of the inferior people. So nations began flexing their muscles just because they could. Because the more they flexed, the more stuff they got that could fuel their industrialism, which in the end resulted in more money being made, which could be pumped back into the system. It's kind of like when I talked about the kings, more, more, more. It's the same basic idea. And last but not least, there was the justification. They were not doing wrong in their eyes. They were doing what they had the right to do. Based on Darwin's, or the social Darwinists' view of natural selection. Because just like the fit eat and the unfit die, strong nations expand, weak nations get conquered. Questions? All right. One more little chunk and then we'll call it a day. The first place these new powers went was they all jumped headlong into Africa. Beginning in the 1860s, all the way up to 1900, the Europeans literally carved up the entire continent because they were driven by resources. Notice, this is what it looked like in 1880. I should have got an older map, but look. They just little dots. All those are little agreements that all the European countries had with local chiefs. But by 1913, there wasn't an open space left. The great powers controlled the entire continent. Why? Well, go back to that last slide. Territory is where you get the raw materials from. Raw materials fuels your industrialization. And the more you produce, the more money you can make. But there was also the competition element. If we don't take it, France will. Or if we don't take it, Germany will. So we're going to take every last acre, even if it's nothing but desert, because you don't know what could be below the desert that could be of value. And of course, the exploitation was justified. One of the most simplistic explanations came from Rudyard Kipling, who was an altruist like Spencer. He argued a theory that Europeans had a duty to bring civilization. In Christianity and modernity to the primitive tribal people of the world. This became known as white man's burden. Why? Well, again, if you go into, in the 19th century, in the middle of Africa, and the people are still wearing primitive tribal clothing that their ancestors wore 1,000 years ago, and you ride in on a carriage or by a steam-powered ship, and you have your fancy cotton clothes and your little pith helmet, and you see the way they are, and you look at the way you are, well, look, I am superior because I came from halfway around the world to get here. And they couldn't do it. So Kipling and others argued it was a duty. God wants them to bring civilization to these peoples. So as a result, there was no compassion. There was no attempt to understand the local cultures, the local traditions. Instead, it was about imposing European standards on them. Heck, you guys know what America did to the Indians? Little Indian kids were taken off the reservations and shipped to schools in Pennsylvania. Their hair was cut. They had to wear American clothes. They had to get American names. They were taught English because there was a desire, similarly, to erase the Indian religion and tribal customs, to essentially make them Americans. Well, the English, the French, the Germans began doing the same thing. Now, again, the irony is it was a relatively recent experience. All the way up until the 19th century, there was little contact. Again, this is a map. All right? This is a map, and all they had explored were rivers. But they had no idea what was actually there, because it wasn't the Europeans that went into Africa. You know, like when we talked about the transatlantic slave trade, it wasn't the Europeans that went in, it was the Africans who got the slaves. So the Europeans pretty much knew it was out on the coast, but that was about it. But it was that thirst for resources that changed. Rubber, gold, oil, diamonds. That pushed the Brits and the Belgians and the French and the Germans to begin pushing in. But the problem is when you have a box of pizza and you have a whole bunch of your buddies over and there's one slice left, who gets it? I don't know how your friends are, but I know back when I was your age, that situation could result in a fist fight on who's going to get the last slice. Well, the Europeans realized the real potential that a war could erupt as the European powers converge on some godforsaken place in Africa. And they realized that that would be foolish. So they created international standards. In 1884, the Germans called all of the countries that were looking to take land in Africa to Berlin to have a conference. 14 powers attended. And these nations agreed on a change in international law. Rules on how they would carve up Africa. And these rules became known as the Principle of Effective Occupation. There's an O-N there. Principles of Effective Occupation. You had full possession of a territory. It was yours. Full possession. If one, you had people there. So in order to effectively occupy a territory, you had to have people there, your people there. You also had to have a treaty with the local leader. So you not only had to be there, but the local leader wanted you to be there. Proof? Three. You were allowed to fly your flag there. So if you had a government building and you could put your flag up in another country, that was a sign that that was your territory. And last but not least, you had control over the country. Four things. You had to have people there, you had to have possession, you had to have treaties, you had to be able to fly your flag there, and you had to be able to control the region. If you had those four things, another European power couldn't come and take the land. It was yours. Questions on those four? Last click. As a result, all of those little dots soon began being traded away, negotiated like trading cards, or taken like trophies. Because the nations didn't care about the people, what they cared was the resources. And eventually the great powers would carve up every last acre of real estate on the continent. And of course they were justified because they were the superior race. Again, by 18th century standards. 19th century standards. Questions? All right, so that's the mindset that's going to drive all of the different other sections throughout the throughout exam three. We're going to see what they did in the various areas of Africa. We're going to then look at what they, using that mindset, did to the Ottoman Empire. And then we're going to go back to China. All motivated by these isms. Questions? All right, cool. We'll see you on Thursday.